All right, part two. Actually, it's a full day later, but this is my first opportunity to complete this. So another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. I am German, but living in Vienna for some years. I hope my English is good enough for communicating with you trouble-free. As an old seeker, I want to say that for me, your talks and writing are only comparable with Tony Parsons. Let me come to a question for which I don't find an answer either by you nor by Tony. How would you describe the phenomenon of death, the death of the body-mind, and whether there will be any kind of a remembrance of that particular person or body-mind or lifetime after passing away? I am 68. And sooner or later, this fact will ensue. So it is understandable that I am walking constantly with that question. But no convincing answer has come thus far. I would be very happy hearing your response. Best wishes." So, before I address this particular question, I want to again mention that when people are asking their various questions, they're hoping that there's going to be one blanket response to a particular question. They're anticipating that someone who has a non-dual perspective is going to have a sense of existence that is exactly the same as every other person who has a non-dual sensibility. And this just isn't true. There's a general agreement on what a non-dual sensibility is. And actually, when I first started expressing my apparent perspective on existence, I didn't call it a non-dual perspective. Other people started calling it a non-dual perspective. And so initially, I didn't really know what a non-dual perspective is. I don't see life in terms of non-duality or duality. There's just the big happening of what we might call now, but even to call it a big happening and now doesn't make any real sense to me. But people were using this term non-duality, so I investigated it a little bit. And I looked at what might be considered the earliest expression of non-duality, the Ashtavakra Gita, in order to get some sense of what this term non-duality might be referring to. So it's generally agreed upon that the Ashtavakra Gita is a non-dual statement, and that it is perhaps the earliest recorded non-dual statement. There might be some that are earlier, I don't really know, but in general, this is one of the earliest. So in examining that, there were some basic aspects of this non-dual perspective. So the first one being that there was this statement that existence, the existence that we know right now, the existence that we live with on a day-to-day basis, has no particular form. Why is that? Because it's always moving and shifting and changing. And so they state outright that these apparent forms are actually more like waves in a big unformed ocean. So life is, right now, the existence that we all experience, that's what they might call the unformed ocean of existence. Why is it an unformed ocean? Because everything that we know of is changing. A second aspect is that it was stating that in this perspective on existence, you come to realize that the action of life isn't something that anyone is doing, and that includes your own actions. So it makes statements like, having realized that no action is ever created or no action is ever accomplished because it's all just happening on its own, that someone with this perspective simply lives with whatever action is presenting itself. And in this, it's basically acknowledging that everything that we think we are is simply also a movement of this larger, unexplainable, unformed ocean of existence. And then a third aspect is that there is no explanation for any of this. And so towards the end of the Ashtavakra Gita, it just spends all his time saying it's not this and it's not that. It's not birth, it's not death, it's not a student, it's not a teacher, it's not a teaching, it's not scriptures, it's not an ignorance, it's not an awakening, it's not, and ultimately it says that it's not duality and it's not non-duality. And then it openly declares that it, whatever this is, it can't be explained in any way whatsoever. Now, it states a lot of other things, but these three aspects basically are presented towards the end of the Ashtavakra Gita, and if we consider them to any degree, we discover that those three aspects undermine anything else that's stated in that ancient expression. And so what we're left with in that consideration, if we relate it to our daily experience, what we're left with is the fact that this event right now, this apparent happening of right now, the apparent happening that any of us are experiencing right now, this is the formless. This is the unformed. Actually, let's use the word unformed because that's a little more specific. If we say the formless, we are again positing a description of existence. But if we say it is without form, that it is without doing, that it is without explanation of any kind, then we're not saying what it is. We're just saying what it isn't. And to say what it isn't doesn't mean that we end up saying there's nothing. We simply say that whatever this is, you know, when we stop trying to describe it in any way whatsoever, even if all the thoughts fall away, there is, it feels as though something's happening. And the most that we can say about that is what it is not. We can look at the usual descriptions that we have of it, that it has form, that we're doing something, that we're separate from the event, and that there's some way of understanding it. If we examine those assumptions to any degree, they will start to fall apart because those assumptions in relation, direct relation to what we would call our direct experience, they don't make any sense. And they don't make any sense to the point that even notions of our direct experience don't make any sense. So once again, we come to absolute puzzlement or wonder. There's no way of saying what any of this is. There's no one doing it. There's no one separate from it. There's no one that's explainable. We don't even know what we are, what we might call I or me. There's no way of saying what that is. Even the arising of the word I and me, there's no way of saying what that is. And so there's simply this, you know, as some of the more recent teachers might express, there's simply this magical dance of ever-shifting appearances. But even to say that is to say too much. And so, ultimately, with this non-dual, this apparent non-dual perspective, we're not left with a focus on thought. There's a simple acknowledgement that it feels like something's happening in this moment, but there's no actual way of saying anything true about what that is. And at the same time, we can't openly deny it because even if we don't think about it, it feels like something's happening here. It's persistently making itself obvious, but there's no way of saying anything at all about this. Or even if there is a this as opposed to a that, all those notions of this and that, which is duality, those don't really make any sense. So duality doesn't seem to really exist. And if duality doesn't exist, then non-duality can't exist because non-duality only makes sense if duality actually exists. Even the notion of duality and non-duality is duality. So ultimately, we're not left with a focus on thought. There's just this apparent happening, and there's no way of saying anything true about it. And it may or may not become obvious that we don't have to be concerned about what thoughts arise and pass away. We don't have to be concerned about any of the arising and passing away because all of that is simply the dance of this greater ocean of existence. And it's moving and shifting on its own. That all of this arising and passing, all of the apparent urges and actions that we felt we were in charge of, or we felt that we had provoked, they aren't actions that we're provoking. There is only action. There is only the absence of form. So some people might call it movement. Some people might call it the formless. Some people might call it the absence of form. It's all simply attempting to point to the fact that whatever this is, it's not standing still in order to be described. It has no particular form. And no one is doing this moving, shifting, dancing action that has no particular form. That's all there is. If we acknowledge what our actual experience of existence is, ultimately that's the bottom line, that it has no particular form. Now, outside of those early statements of non-duality, it's also a portion of my apparent perspective, or there's another aspect to this, and that is that within the apparent world of form, no two apparent things are identical. So even though there is no actual form to existence, that everything that we identify is changing to some degree. So in that storyline that we usually have, our usual story of our experience of existence, all the many apparent things are changing. And they're not only, you know, it's that they're constantly changing. Some of them are changing very slowly. Some of them are changing very quickly, but they're all changing. So in this world of apparent form, no two apparent things are identical. No two snowflakes are identical. No two leaves are identical. No two trees are identical. No two people have the same pulse rate, the same breath rate. No two people have the same skin composition. Each and every apparent thing in existence is a unique expression. So getting back to these questions that people are sending in, people are expecting me to offer some blanket statement about how to view life, how to view this non-dual experience. And I can't offer that because you can't have my exact perspective on existence, my exact sense of existence. Even if we agree on something called non-duality, you cannot have my exact sense of existence, because within the world of apparent form, each of us is a unique expression. So, in relation to this question about death, I can offer you my sensibility. I have no idea whether you will be able to relate to that, because it's within this world of apparent form. If I'm going to talk about the birth and death of something, we're going to be within this world of apparent form, because ultimately there is no birth or death of any form. There is only this great mysterious action. The notion of the birth and death of particular forms is a mirage. There is only an unformed happening. Or that's the best I can do in just simply saying that whatever is happening in this moment, it has no particular form. So within the world of apparent forms, if you're asking me what my sense of that world is, it's going to be a unique sense. You can't have my exact sensibility, and I can't have your exact sensibility. So as long as we are clear on this, I'll respond to this question of, you know, what is my sense of the phenomenon of death, the death of the body-mind, and whether there will be any kind of remembrance of that particular person or body, mind, or lifetime after passing away. So my particular sense of the world of forms is that it's a mirage. And the notion that something is born and something is passing away is a mirage. Because all within my apparent world of experience, all I ever experience is a great moving, shifting, dancing event. Now, even though something like a mountain or an automobile, the shape of an automobile, doesn't seem to be fading away within a few seconds, my lifetime experience has, like, I've seen the bodies of old cars rusting away, literally disappearing, but disappearing very slowly. Each and every apparent thought that I have disappears in an instant. I've noticed my body aging much more quickly than the body of a car rusts away. it becomes very obvious that at one apparent time I was a quarter of an inch long in my mother's womb, and then I was a foot and a half long outside of my mother's womb, and I was moving and shifting in all kinds of obvious ways. I grew larger. I seemed to go through something called my teen years and then into early adulthood, and now I'm into my early 60s, and it's still not stopping. It's the whole thing is just continuing to express itself as this event that has no particular form. During any apparent day, I have the sense that existence is some feeling of presence. That even if all the thoughts fall away in certain apparent moments, there is this feeling of presence that makes itself obvious. It's just the feeling that something, the general feeling that something is happening here, happening now. However, even that isn't the specific form of what I might call life or existence, because it's also the case that it all seems to fade away in what we call the evening and night. And in the middle of the night, apparently, in deep sleep, what we might call deep sleep, I don't even have a sense of presence. There isn't anything making itself obvious. And then all of a sudden this sense of presence starts again. And even though I can't somehow say there was anything happening in the night, I'm not left with the feeling that there was no gap between last night and this morning. There's a vague sense that there was some kind of gap. So whatever this is, it seems to be, you know, for lack of any other words, there seems to be a continual happening that has no particular form. But even as I say that, it sounds ridiculous because nothing continues. There is no continuance of any particular form from moment to moment. All the forms are changing. So this is why I'm always saying that these descriptions of existence are just ridiculous. They're just gibberish. But everyone would like to nail down one specific understanding of existence that we can all agree on. In my experience, there isn't any particular experience of existence that we can all agree on. There are some general agreements, but no specific agreement. So before I even consider the birth and death of any particular form, my underlying sense of existence is that there is no coming and going. There's just a happening that has no particular form, and it's always a happening that has no particular form. Notions of certain forms in existence are like looking at smoke, and we see the various shapes that the smoke is presenting, and maybe for one moment the smoke might look like the letter C. But even in the moment that we apparently identify that, it's gone, because it's not, smoke isn't the letter C. It's an action that has no particular form. So even though it looks like the letter C came into existence and passed away, that's not what happened. There is just always this ongoing presence of the smoke, and it has no particular form. So we can look at it as the birth and death of the letter C, or we can look at it as simply the ongoing presence of the smoke, and the smoke has no particular form. In the same way, my sense of existence is that there's this ongoing event or happening, and it has no particular form. There is no coming and going. There's just a mysterious happening that has no form. So that seems somewhat abstract, perhaps, for some. So let's make it even more specific. In my own sense of this body and my apparent mind, so my apparent body and my apparent mind, what is my sense of what's going to happen at death? Well, every night there's what I would call sleep, and deep sleep. And in that deep sleep, I have no sense of anything happening. There is no me concerned about having no sense of anything happening, because there just flat out isn't any sense of anything happening. So in, you know, it's not that when I'm in deep sleep, I'm sitting there with a sense that nothing is happening. It's only apparently later that there's the feeling that there wasn't any sense of existence or sense of presence. However, there is this vague notion that there was something called deep sleep. So it isn't exactly true that there was flat out no sense of presence. Because if there was absolutely no sense of presence, then there wouldn't be any feeling of any gap between last night and this morning. So I can't really say what's going on there, but on one hand, I didn't have a sense of presence, and on the other hand, I have this vague notion that there was some kind of gap. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know what any of this is. The descriptions of what this is make no sense. I can't say there was no sense of presence, but there was a sense of presence. That makes no sense. These descriptions are always in contradiction with each other. However, in that apparent deep sleep, I don't have a memory of feeling worried about anything, or being concerned about anything, or having a life story. All of those things are apparently absent in deep sleep. And I don't have the sense that I'm going to have more of a life story when I'm dead, when all of this present appearance fades away, this apparent body and mind fade away in what we would call death. I don't have the sense that I'm going to be more alert than I am when I'm in deep sleep. I mean, death just seems like a deeper sleep. But overall, I don't have the impression that anything is going to be lost, because I'm not a body and a mind. I'm not any particular form. Whatever I am, it's a portion of this. Actually, how would I say this? It's, there is only this happening that has no particular form. There's no me that exists as something separate from this happening that has no particular form. If I use the word I, in that, all it does is point back to this apparent body, but I don't have the sense that this is an apparent body. I don't have the sense that this is something with a form that can be identified, nor is it a mind, something called a mind. It's a totally unexplainable event that has no particular form. So, my underlying sense of death is that there isn't anything ever coming and going. There's just a happening, an unexplainable happening that has never had any form. And that's, if I use the word I, that's what I am. And even that description isn't what I am. It's simply pointing to whatever this is that can't be described in any way whatsoever and never presents itself as any continuous thing at all. So, in this sense of death, do I have the feeling that there's going to be a remembrance of any particular person? No, because my sense of deep sleep every night, every apparent night, is that there isn't any movement of thought. That the entire sense of something presenting itself is absent. All the things that I would consider to be a sense of presence or the happening of the moment, all of that fades away, only to apparently return, because whatever this is, it doesn't have any particular form. It's not a presence and it's not an absence. It's not an existence and it's not a non-existence. Whatever this is, there's no blanket term for it. There's no thing that it ever presents itself as in any continuous manner. And so, in my own sense of this, you know, I've read Ramana Maharshi's process of dying, or description of Ramana Maharshi dying, and his students would come to him and say, or his disciples would come to him and say, "We're so unhappy because we're going to lose you. We won't have you around." And he apparently was very puzzled. He would say to them, like, "Where am I going to go? I'm the here and now." You know, basically he was saying, like, "I am the only thing that's happening. Like, where am I going to go?" And an extension of that is, just because it seems to change shape doesn't mean the basic happening goes anywhere. It's just that it doesn't have any particular shape. So I don't know if any of this is something that this person can relate to, but this is all that's coming up in response to this question. Again, even if we can generally agree on what we would call a non-dual sensibility, it doesn't mean that our apparent experience of existence, our particular sense of existence within the apparent world of form, it doesn't mean that that experience is going to be identical to anyone else's. Each of us, within that apparent world of form, each of us is a unique expression. All right, another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. Thank you very much for your wonderful and inspiring books. I do, however, have a problem regarding the view that there are no mistakes in this mysterious movement, which is accomplishing itself. The sufferings of change may be due to the natural growth and decay of apparently existing forms. Infectious diseases may be advantageous to the infectious organisms involved. I accept that nature can be cruel in apparently promoting the advantage of one creature over another when competition or conflict occurs. However, to the question which squirrel is not doing its squirreling properly, I would answer, a deformed one. Defects in apparent forms do occur. Some of these defects, in certain circumstances, may result in the evolution of adaptations advantageous to the apparent life forms involved. It would seem that nature is prepared to experiment and take risks. Nevertheless, it is hard to make sense of a defect such as cancer, which appears to convey no advantages to the affected creatures whatsoever. Several famous non-dual teachers have suffered from cancer, and I would therefore expect the tradition to have something to say on this matter. Have you any thoughts regarding this issue? Kind regards. The first thing that pops up is at the apparent time that I was apparently involved with Vipassana groups, there was one particular time when so many well-known Buddhist teachers and Vipassana teachers were dying of cancer that there was actually a poster pinned to a bulletin board at one of the major Vipassana centers, and it basically just stated that meditation does not cause cancer. But generally, in relation to this question, the bottom line in what I'm presenting is that there is no legitimate explanation of what's happening in this apparent moment. The apparent existence that any of us apparently are experiencing, there is no legitimate description of that. All of these descriptions are filled with contradiction and conflict. We can consider that there is no actual form to be described. There is no form that sticks around. We can't say that existence is a particular form to be described. We can't, you know, in an examination of these words that we use, like perfection and defect, these have no real meaning. They're just pointing to apparent forms that we compare, and we say one is perfection and the other is a defect. And all of this is a fantasy, because those apparent forms are not what's actually happening here. What's actually happening here is a happening, or the best I can say is happening here, is a happening that has no particular form to be described. It cannot legitimately be described in any way whatsoever, even though apparent descriptions arise, and even with this non-dual sensibility, those descriptions are going to arise anyway. Those apparent descriptions are going to arise. They themselves are simply a totally unexplainable happening. But in that sensibility, if we have absolutely no idea of what's happening here, we can't start saying there's something wrong with it any more than we can say that it's totally perfect. I mean, I have in the past said there is just the perfect expression of existence. But even saying that isn't quite correct. And I just point that out because these perceptions, these perspectives, it seems there are many different perspectives that can be adopted. And in considering life, we might find that different perspectives arise. So in one situation, there may be the perspective that there's something wrong with the situation, but if it's considered in a somewhat different fashion, then we end up saying, well, no, it's the perfect dance of existence. But to say anything at all about existence is to go off the mark. There isn't any legitimate statement about existence. Notions of perfection and defects and black and white and up and down and in and out and non-duality and duality and presence and absence, all of these are just trying to grab on to the world of form and come up with some blanket statement about existence. But if we try to grab onto the world of form and then acknowledge that there are no legitimate forms there to describe in the first place, it's just a passing appearance of something that ultimately has no form, then all of these notions have no meaning. And the contradiction within these storylines is very obvious here in pretty much the first statement that this person has made. He says, I have a problem regarding the view that there are no mistakes in this mysterious movement, which is accomplishing itself. Now, why would you have a problem with a description of a totally mysterious movement that's accomplishing itself? Because you're acknowledging that it's a totally mysterious movement. Why would there be any focus on whether or not it has mistakes in it? Because the notion of mistakes is a description. And so it is, this is the difficulty in this world of thought. From a non-dual perspective, and that's all that I'm offering here, I'm not asking anybody to look at life in any particular way. I'm simply apparently presenting a non-dual perspective, and you either agree with it or you don't agree with it. From a non-dual perspective, there is no possible description of what is apparently happening here. No possible true description. So you can't truly say it's perfect. You can't truly say it has mistakes. You can't truly say anything about it. All of that exists within the world. Like all of these notions of perfection or mistakes or duality or non-duality, that exists within the world of description. And a non-dual, an apparent non-dual sensibility is saying there is no possible description for this, whatever this is. And that even includes the notion of non-duality. What we would call traditionally a non-dual perspective doesn't even have notions of duality and non-duality. There isn't any ultimate focus on the world of description, even though those apparent descriptions continue to arise and pass away. They are not what's actually happening here. What's described is not what's actually happening here. And so even without a focus on this world of description, the descriptions come and go in their appropriate time, in whatever way they come and go. Those apparent descriptions come and go on their own, because even without a focus on the world of thought, there is the feeling that there is this event, this eventing, this happening, this moving, shifting, dancing happening. And so that is acknowledged as somehow primary. And ultimately, the world of description isn't even that important, because all of that is simply a portion of this moving, shifting, unexplainable happening. Now, often people have the sense that if we do have this non-dual perspective, that somehow that leaves us outside of the apparently terrible things like cancer. But it's not the fact. All this is saying is that this world that we're experiencing right now, this sense of self that we're experiencing right now, this world of apparent form that we're experiencing right now, a situation of a self and a world and all of these various experiences that a self is having in a world, This is a description of existence that's not true. So, a world in which there exists perfection and imperfection, a world in which there exists sickness and health, that doesn't actually exist. But to say this from this non-dual perspective is not saying that the happening that we call cancer doesn't exist. It's just that there's no way of saying what it is. It's not an objective reality. It's not a subjective reality. It's not a cancer. It's not health. It's not sickness. There's no way of saying what it is. It's just this doing what it does. And so it is that Ramana Maharshi apparently died of cancer. Ajahn Chah, the great Thai meditation master, suffered a rupture in the blood vessels of his brain and was left in a semi-comatose state for about 10 years, sitting in a wheelchair. Moggallana, one of the two most enlightened, so-called enlightened followers of the Buddha, walked into a village and was stoned to death. There are any number of stories. The Buddha suffered from a bad back. The pain of that back was so extreme that at certain times he couldn't even finish a teaching. He had to ask somebody else to finish the teaching because the pain was so overwhelming. He had to go lie down in order to deal with that pain. Having a non-dual sensibility doesn't mean you're going to avoid the apparent pains of existence. And from this non-dual perspective, if we focus on the world of descriptions and begin to wonder, well, what's cancer all about? Cancer really isn't something that's advantageous to existence. So what's that all about? It must be a defect. Well, all of that's fantasy. How can you say that cancer is not advantageous to existence when you don't even know what existence is? The whole notion that there's something called cancer is a fantasy. So from this non-dual perspective, ultimately we're left with great caution regarding the apparent world of stories. Because the moment the focus goes on those world of stories and wants to play with those world of stories, there's a huge amount of suffering that comes along with it. And that's not saying that with a non-dual perspective, there's never a focus on the world of stories. It's just an acknowledgement that once you're into the world of stories, it's going to start presenting all kinds of conflicts and contradictions and will carry its own sense of suffering. That focus will carry its own sense of suffering. So if there is something general that the tradition of non-duality would have to say about cancer, it would probably be a general statement that the whole notion that there is something called cancer as an imperfection or an illness, or that there is any legitimate thing called cancer, is a fantasy. But be very careful with that, because that's not saying the happening that we would normally call cancer doesn't exist. It doesn't say that the happening that we would call the imperfect movement of existence doesn't exist. It's just saying that whatever this is that seems to be making itself obvious, this happening that we might call existence, there's no way of saying what that is. There's no way of understanding that. There is no understanding. Even the notion of understanding is a fantasy. Ask a baby that's 1 hour old what their understanding of existence is. And for the baby, there isn't even a question. There isn't any notion of understanding. Within the world of apparent stories, some apparent adult is going to have to program a child to think that life is about non-understanding and understanding. We're going to have to program that child to think in terms of sickness and health, black and white, up and down, good and bad. The child that is apparently 1 hour old doesn't have that description of existence. And the child will pick up a description from the society around it. But there isn't anybody in that society that arrived with a storyline. They had to be programmed to bark certain sounds. In relation to talking about certain forms. But if we sit down and we examine our experience of existence, life has no long-lasting form. It's always moving and shifting and changing. And the words that we got to label those forms are just meaningless sound. In a different country, in a different language, it's a different sound. It can be any sound. It can be blix, flute, and wazzle. So instead of using words like cancer, instead of using words like health and illness, let's use words like blix and flute and wazzle. So instead of talking about health and illness and cancer, let's talk about blix and flute and wazzle. So if you're asking me to explain what blix, the whole notion of blix and flute and wazzle, do I have a comment on the labels of blix and flute and wazzle? Yes, they're gibberish. They have no ultimate meaning at all. Even if they can be apparently functional on a day-to-day basis, they have no ultimate meaning. It's a fantasy to think that we can describe existence with sounds like blix and flute and wazzle. And in that, I'm simply saying that sounds like health and illness and cancer are just meaningless sounds. Attempting to describe something that can't be described. Or attempting to find a true description when a true description of existence can't be found. Again, this is just from this what we might generally call a non-dual perspective. This is not the one and only way to view existence. It's not the one true way of describing existence or relating to existence or pointing to existence. From a non-dual perspective, it's just one of the mysterious expressions of existence. If you apparently relate to it, that's great. If you apparently don't relate to it, that's great. Existence is just going to express itself in whatever way it expresses itself. All right, another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, I remember reading somewhere that morphine doesn't actually take away pain, but somehow puts a distance between the sufferer and the pain so that it no longer seems to matter. I've no idea whether this is true, since thankfully I've never had to take morphine. The reason I mention this is that I suspect that many of us are drawn to non-duality because we hope that it will have the same effect as morphine. We are not so naive as to expect it to take the pain away, but we want to put a space between ourselves and our suffering, or maybe arrive at a situation where there is suffering but no one doing the suffering, or words to that effect. However, when I'm in a pessimistic mood about non-duality, I recall this quote from the French writer François Duc de la Rochefoucauld. And this is the quotation. Our philosophy conquers our past and future problems. Our present problems conquer our philosophy. I've no idea what was going through Francois's mind when he wrote that, but what it says to me is that philosophies and perspectives are fine for looking at things in retrospect or in prospect, but they are not going to help us much in the heat of the moment when things get really bad. So a non-dual perspective, for example, is great at about 7 o'clock in the evening when we're relaxing with a cup of tea or a glass of wine, but it's not going to get much of a look in when we're faced with that difficult person at work, or we've made a stupid mistake or said something stupid, or suddenly realized we're 20,000 pounds in debt, or frazzled with stress and fatigue, etc., etc., etc. So non-duality as morphine, or a retrospective balm for all our woes? Oh, so he's saying, so basically the situation of non-duality as morphine, in which case we're hoping that it's going to dull the pain, or as a retrospective balm for all our woes, you know, something that we can just consider in the calm moments, but it doesn't really have much to do with the real difficulties of existence. And he's asking, what do you think is closer to the truth? Or maybe neither is anywhere near the truth. And then in brackets, he says, nearly every word there should be in quotes, but I think we can take that as read. Many thanks for your talks. They give me a reason to look forward to each new month. This is a great point, because I'm always trying to express this, and it gives me a chance to express this once more, or attempt to express this once more, that this non-dual perspective is not going to take away the pain of life. The things that we call extreme pain in existence, even if we can't legitimately say that that is something called extreme pain, the happening that is extreme pain is still going to be presenting itself. There isn't anybody who's going to escape it. There isn't anything to escape. There is just this moving, shifting, dancing event, and in certain moments it seems excruciating, what we would call excruciating pain, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain, and in other moments it seems extremely pleasant. It's not pleasure or pain, because there's no way of saying what it is, but to acknowledge that is not going to take away the happening that we call pain or the happening that we call pleasure. It's going to go on presenting itself in the way that it's been presenting itself. And so someone like Ramana Maharshi pointed out that you're not going to find any freedom unless you have the ability to be indifferent to pain and pleasure. And that means basically you end up unconcerned about pain and pleasure. And you cannot train yourself to be unconcerned about pain and pleasure. The only way that you can truly be unconcerned about it, or there can be any true lack of concern about it, is in the realization that life is going to present both of those apparent things. Whether you like it or not, it's going to present it. So you're left with a situation of there's going to be the pain. Now you can weep and wail and moan about it or not. Either way, you're going to have what we would call pain. And so the freedom within a non-dual expression or perspective is simply that the acknowledgement that life's going to present whatever it presents, and we're not going to avoid what we call pain any more than we're going to evade or avoid what we call pleasure. Now, we can hope that that might happen, but I've never met anybody for whom that has happened. that they somehow ended up having no pain, no apparent pain, with a non-dual perspective. However, I've run across a lot of writings and a lot of apparent people with a non-dual, an apparent non-dual perspective that will say, yeah, I don't know what any of this is. It just keeps presenting whatever it presents. And at times, it really hurts. So this non-dual perspective can take away the suffering of wanting life to be perfect, or let me put it this way, I can take away the pain of wanting life to only be a golden glowing moment without any pain. So it can take away that suffering, because what it takes away is a demand that life be something that it's not. So we stop asking life to be something that it can't be, and so the pain or the suffering of not being able to get that falls away. The mental conflict, the apparent mental conflict and anguish over life not being what we want it to be, that's the pain, that's the anguish that gets removed. And what we're left with is, and that, I should say that that pain, that anguish, the hope that life is going to be something that it can't possibly be, that will fall away to greater or lesser apparent degrees, depending on, you know, each and every expression of that falling away in each apparent person. So that mental anguish falls away, the mental anguish of trying to figure out what life is all about, because there's a realization that there is no actual explanation for any of this. The quest for a perfect self that's in control all the time falls away, because there's the realization there isn't anybody in control of this. It's always just being this totally mysterious event presenting itself. And the hope to find some technique or system for always making everything perfect, the agony of that search falls away, because no matter what apparent techniques we apparently learn for improving our life, we don't end up with absolute control. And if we consider it to any degree, we realize that even our apparent learning of certain apparent techniques to make our life better, even that wasn't our particular doing. It's also the dance of this larger mysterious happening, or this basic mysterious happening. So is this non-dual perspective going to be a kind of morphine that will dull the pains of existence? No, in some cases, what we might call the physical pain of existence is going to become even more of a sensitive event, because there's a very, what we might call a very direct acknowledgement of it. And there's no way of dulling that. You know, even the medical establishment, which has all of its drugs and basically portrays itself as being able to offer us relief from any kind of physical pain, it's not true. There are physical pains that the medical establishment can do absolutely nothing about. And acknowledging that physical pain as a totally mysterious happening isn't going to get rid of what we call pain. It's a legitimate expression of whatever this is. And is a non-dual perspective then a retrospective balm for all of our woes? In a way, you could say that that's true, because outside of the physical pain, outside of those extreme moments of difficulty that life is manifesting or pushing forward, in those moments of apparent calm, there may be the acknowledgement that all of this is just simply the legitimate dance of existence. There's nothing wrong with it, essentially. It's just a totally unexplainable happening doing what it does. And that somehow it's okay. Now the Buddha actually had a very direct teaching on this. He said there was only one difference between the average person on the street and his students that had awakened. And he said the only difference is this, that the average person on the street suffers the pains of existence twice. They suffer the pain that life is presenting, and then there's this whole mental story of, why me, poor me, this shouldn't be like this, why is this happening to me, oh, this is so terrible, why it shouldn't be happening to me, I'm a good person, I should not be getting this. So he said this average person on the street is suffering the pains of life twice. There is this, the actual pain that life's presenting, and then there is this mental anguish about it, saying that it shouldn't be happening, relating it all to a personal me. Why me, poor me, only me? And he said his learned followers, his enlightened followers, they suffered the pains of life only once. Their life has pain. What's the problem? So here's a very essential question. Like, why does anybody think life shouldn't have pain? We don't know what any of this actually is, so why do we go around thinking that it shouldn't have pain? Now, it's very natural that we don't want the pain. And it's a natural portion of the expression of whatever this is that we'll do our best to try to avoid all the pain, but it's also a very natural expression of whatever this is that we eventually have to come to acknowledge that no matter how much we would like it to be pain-free, it's not, and it never will be. And even if we acknowledge that what we call pain really isn't something called pain, that doesn't get rid of the mysterious happening that we label as pain. It just says it's a totally mysterious happening. That has no particular form. It's always presenting these passing appearances of form. And one of the passing appearances is pain. One of the passing appearances is confusion, is anguish, mental anguish. Even though it's not physical pain, it's not mental pain, it's still a happening that presents itself, the happening that we call physical pain and mental pain, that still happens. And so, as I pointed out, someone like Ramana Maharshi would say, you can't come to freedom unless you become unconcerned about these passing appearances of pain and pleasure. Because the freedom is the acknowledgement that there is just this great unformed happening, moving and shifting in the way that it does, and that's all there is. There's no little me that's suffering from that great unformed happening. There is only the unformed happening. Everything that we think of as I or me is also the unexplainable unformed happening. So that's all that's coming up in this, in relation to this question. Oh, that's not true. There's something else coming up here. It's again, the Buddha said that no matter how awakened you become, life will have apparent pains that you will simply have to endure. And you're not going to endure it because you're going to decide to endure it. You're going to have to endure it. Or it's just going to play out in whatever way it plays out. All right, moving on here, we have another person who wrote in saying, "Dear Daryl, thanks for your monthly responses to questions. My question is, several so-called awakened beings have said that liberation or enlightenment is simply a falling away of the senses of being a person, or the sense of being a person. And Rupert Spira, Francis Lucille, and Tony Parsons allude to this sense as being an embodied energy in the body that gets released once the sense of being a person vanishes. Ramesh Balsekar said that enlightenment was simply the sense that the sense of being the doer drops away. What is your view on this?" Okay, so certain apparent non-dual teachers are saying that enlightenment includes the sense that there's an embodied energy in the body, and that gets released once the sense of being a person vanishes. And another non-dual teacher is saying that enlightenment is simply the sense of doership falling away. And what is my view on this? Again, non-duality, a non-dual sensibility, is just a general agreement on certain aspects of existence. So there's a general agreement that it has no particular form. There's a general agreement that there is no legitimate explanation for anything that seems to be happening in existence. There is a general agreement that there is no one doing existence, that there is no person separate from the unexplainable, unformed happening of this moment, that most basic sense of existence. Now, over and above these general expressions, within the, it doesn't get rid of the world of apparent form, and within the world of apparent form, each and every apparent form is unique, and that also applies to so-called awakened beings. So in each so-called awakening, even though there really isn't something legitimately called awakening, and the whole storyline of ignorance and awakening is a total fantasy, within that world of apparent form and within that world of apparent happening, each and every apparent happening that can be described or that is described is unique. And so it is that each and every apparent non-dual teacher has a different way of expressing this, even though they can kind of generally agree on certain points. Within the world of apparent form, each and every non-dual teacher will describe a different sense of existence. So in some cases, like Ramesh Balsekar was ultimately said, it didn't really matter to him whether somebody was seeing that descriptions of existence were legitimate or not legitimate. It didn't really matter to him whether somebody was focusing on any other aspect of non-duality. The only thing that he was concerned with was that this notion of being the doer falls away. That none of us is doing the event of existence. We're not even doing the event that we call I or me. It's just a happening, happening on its own. And someone else is going to say that there is an embodied energy in the body that gets released once the sense of being a person vanishes. So now there's somebody focusing on this whole sense of being a body, and that vanishes. The notion that the body is some kind of solid lump that actually contains something, that falls away in the realization that the body itself is just a moving, shifting, dancing event, a vibrating, a pulsating, a warming, cooling, sounding, silencing, lightening, darkening, eventing that has no particular form. So it's, you could say it's a process, you could say it's a subtle liveliness, you could say it's unformed. There are many ways of expressing this, and in each and every apparent non-dual expression, it's different, and it can seem to be radically different, or it can seem to be slightly different, but each and every expression is going to be unique. So again, if we look at the oldest expressions of what has come to be known as a non-dual expression, if we look at something like the Ashtavakra Gita, then we come to certain basic points that are agreed upon. One being that the apparent forms in existence are not legitimately forms, that existence somehow has no particular form, it just appears to have form, so the appearance of form is like a mirage, and every one of us knows that because we ultimately will say that everything is changing once we've experienced life to a certain degree, apparently experienced life to a certain degree. So then, along with that unformed aspect, we can't say there is any legitimate explanation for existence because there isn't any particular form to describe. Is it light? Well, wait a while, it's going to be dark. Is it dark? Well, wait a while, it's going to be light. Is it confusion? Well, wait a while, it's going to feel like it's clarity. Is it clarity? Well, wait a while, it's going to feel like confusion. Is it joy? Well, wait a while, it's going to feel like sorrow. Is it sorrow? Well, wait a while, it's going to feel like joy. And so it is. There's just this unformed, magical dance of passing appearances. That's another way of saying it. Now, also there's the agreement that we don't exist as anything apart from this unformed event presenting itself, because we're also an unformed event, and we're not making ourselves happen. If you sit down and make no attempt to do anything at all, everything that you are is going to present itself anyway, including the urge to move and go do something else. Now, over and above that general agreement, you can agree on these things, and one apparent person may still have quite a strong focus on form, and not have what you might call a subtle sense of the vibrating, pulsating quality of the moment and of the body. And yet there can be this general agreement that life ultimately has no form, there's no real explanation for it, and no one is doing it. There is no person that's separate from this unformed, unexplainable happening, and yet they don't have a subtle sense of vibration or pulsation in each and every moment. And you have another apparent individual that, for them, the only thing of any real importance is this subtle, vibrating, moving, shifting, pulsing quality of the moment. As I point out, for each and every apparent person, it's unique. And for each and every apparent awakened being, it's unique. So don't expect that your awakening is going to be like someone else's awakening. And don't expect that your the so-called results of that awakening are going to be exactly like anybody else's. And don't expect that the sense of existence that's going to arise with a non-dual sensibility is going to be exactly like somebody else's sense of existence. There's just a general agreement that whatever this is, it has no form, it's presenting itself, and there isn't anything existing from this unformed, unexplainable happening that's simply happening. And here's where some of the real confusion in this non-dual expression arises, because people listen to all of these different expressions of a non-dual sensibility, and along with the general agreement, each and every non-dual teacher is also throwing in their particular expression, their particular sense of existence. And that, you know, we might all generally agree on certain aspects of a non-dual perspective, but we're not going to end up with the same particular sense of existence within that world of apparent form. Some people are focused on emotion, some people are focused on physical sensation, what we would call physical sensation. Some people are focused on abstract notions of existence, some people are focused on relationships, some people are focused on any number of things. Some people have a subtle sense that life is a vibrating, pulsating event. Some people just have a general sense that it's an unformed flowing without any extreme sense of vibration or pulsation or any focus on that. And so it is here we get this confusion, because a non-dual teacher is presenting both this general sense of life being unformed, unexplainable, and unprovoked, that there is no one separate from the event making it happen, that we ourselves are simply an expression of this unexplainable, unformed happening. But along with that, in their use of language, in their attempt to point to this, they're using their own particular sense of existence. And there may be some agreement with other apparent people, but each and every apparent person is a unique expression in some way. So that unique expression is also getting related somehow in the general presentation of a non-dual perspective. So you might agree with the general sense of non-duality, but you will never end up having, you know, even if you have this so-called non-dual sensibility, you're not going to end up moment to moment having exactly the same sense of existence as another person with a non-dual sensibility. You will be unique in some way within that world of apparent form. So, you know, because people don't acknowledge that, they go from teacher to teacher and they're hoping to find one description that matches their own. One detailed description of existence that matches their own, one detailed approach to life and death that will make them, make sense to them, and that they'll be able to grab onto. One unique sense of the moment that they'll be able to grab onto. And you can't find that, because even with the general agreement of a non-dual perspective, each and every apparent person will, on a moment-to-moment basis, have what we would call a different experience of existence. Okay, this is running on again, but I just have a few questions left, so we'll just let this run on. Another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, thanks for your monthly responses to questions. My question is..." Oh, sorry, I'm gotten a bit confused here. All right. Another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. I've read your three books and found them very clear and helpful in many ways. I've also signed up for your UK intensive later this year and look forward to meeting you then. I was initially drawn to Buddhism, with which I felt a certain resonance, but found the many various and often contradictory writings thereon somewhat baffling and confusing. When I came across Advaita sometime later, I found myself understanding what I had previously found confusing. Having read so many different non-dual texts in both Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta, it still seems that proponents of either tradition have vigorously disagreed with those of the other. For example, Shankara is reputed to have outwitted a delegation of Buddhist scholars in debate. Personally, maybe through my own ignorance, I have found the distinctions argued over as somewhat academic. Nevertheless, there seems one major difference which seems to have some import, and that is in regard to whether there is a substratum to existence. Buddha himself seems to have been reluctant to speculate on such matters. Nagarjuna, however, seems to have come out strongly against any idea of substratum, of a substratum self, Brahman, Parabrahman, pure consciousness or awareness. At least that is how he seems to be interpreted in saying his way is a middle way between nihilism and eternalism, though I am not sure by eternalism he was dismissing the self with a capital S, rather than simply dismissing permanence. In Advaita, of course, such a self with a capital S is clearly indicated. There again, other Buddhists, such as Wang Po, do speak of the mind, with a capital M, being the original Buddha nature, the highest truth, devoid of any atom of objectivity, void, omnipresent, silent, pure, glorious, and mysterious, peaceful joy. Given your background in Buddhism and your connection with Advaita teachers such as Robert Adams, I would be grateful for your view on this. I appreciate the view that the Buddha's teachings were primarily aimed at the relief of people's suffering in this life rather than dealing with metaphysical speculation, and the approach that life is a dance, so to speak, with no actual independent autonomous entities anywhere to be found, can go a long way in alleviating existential angst. However, the absence of any definitive view on any ultimate reality seems to me to leave open the question of whether, on the apparent disappearance of this particular apparent form that I think of as me, there is an indescribable, inconceivable no-thingness, which is nevertheless conscious, or a nothingness equivalent to absolute oblivion, more akin to the scientific view that all of this comes out of pure nothing. Sorry for the length of this." All right. So the basic question here is there a substratum to existence, or isn't there a substratum to the existence that we know? So is the teaching presenting the notion that there is some reality existing outside of our usual views of existence, something that's underlying what we experience in this moment? And he's pointing out that when you read what has been written about a non-dual perspective, that we seem to have teachers that are saying there is a substratum, and there are teachers who don't bother to speculate on such matters, and there are teachers that seem to be saying there is a substratum. And this person is saying that his feeling is that it all seems to be somewhat academic. And that's my sense of it. It seems as though, although I can't say for sure, but it does seem as though in a lot of cases, all of this is merely a matter of semantics. So let's take someone that I have read, the teachings of Wang Po, so this great Zen master. And he does say that everything is Buddha mind, with a capital M, and that that is Buddha nature, that each one of us has Buddha nature, and that that is mind with a capital M. So that gives us the impression that he's saying that underlying our usual views of life being a bunch of things, that actually it's something we might call consciousness. However, if we read very carefully what he's saying, he says everything is Buddha mind with a capital M, and that it is everything we see. It's everything we see right now. That is what he calls mind with a capital M. And that it has no form. So he's just saying outright that everything you see right now, and by extension, it's also everything you hear, touch, taste, smell, and think, all of that is mind with a capital M, and it has no form. So now, is he saying there is something that we can experience, something other than what we see around us right now? I don't have that impression. He's just saying that what we see right now has no form, which is what all of us say when we say that everything is changing. We see form, but we ultimately say that these forms are changing. So that this word mind is simply pointing to the unformed actuality of the moment. Now, he doesn't just use the word mind with a capital M. He's using the word Buddha nature, and in many cases these Zen masters would say it's our original nature, or our basic nature, is an unformed happening. But any one of us can say that. And in some cases, certain teachers will say that existence, the unformed happening, is the substratum to the world of form. But they're not saying there's something else to experience. They're simply saying that what we see right now actually has no form, even though it seems to have form. And so the so-called reality, the real substratum to existence, is just what we're experiencing right now. It's just a simple acknowledgement that what seems to be form is not actually form. It's not that we're going to experience the form disappearing, all fading away right now, and all we will experience is a total absence of form. It's that the realization is simply that even though we're seeing form, that's not actually what's existing. That what this is, what seems to have form, does not have form. And so the substratum, the unformed happening, is exactly the same thing that we're seeing right now. So it is that within certain Buddhist traditions, they will say that the world of suffering is nirvana. That with awakening, the world of suffering is seen to be not a world of suffering at all, because that's a particular description of existence, and that description doesn't apply to whatever this is. And so the world of apparent form, what we experience right now, with awakening, with the realization that it is a totally mysterious, unexplainable happening, this world of samsara, this world of form, is actually seen to be nirvana. And nirvana, in a very direct teaching of the Buddha, Nirvana is the absence of dependence on form. So the world of suffering is the focus on this world of form and the hope that we can depend on some form, some particular idea that's going to come up, some particular experience that's going to come up, some particular thing that we're going to have, that we're going to be able to depend on this form to keep us happy. And that expectation is always frustrated, and there's a suffering in that, an existential angst. Why can't I find one lasting explanation of existence? Why can't I find the relationship that's going to keep me happy all the time? Why can't I find a career that's going to supply all of my wants and it's going to fulfill all of my wants and I'll be happy forever? Why can't I find that form that I can cling to? So that existential angst will fall away when we realize that there isn't any essential form here. And so that suffering falls away. And what was seen to be a world of suffering now becomes nirvana, the absence of a dependency on form. And as Ryokan, the great Zen poet, expressed it, existence has no particular root. Find joy in the ever-shifting flow. So it's simply saying that here it is, folks, life presenting itself the way it presents itself. It's got highs and lows, clarities and confusions, joys and sorrows, and we're going to have to simply appreciate those moments of joy that it presents and endure the moments of apparent difficulty that it presents. And none of it is explainable. We're not making any of it happen. It has no particular form. Now, there is always going to be someone who comes along who says, no, that's not what this is expressing. It's expressing something totally different. It's saying there is a reality outside of this usual sense of form, and in this awakening, the whole world of form is going to vanish and we're going to go off to some blissful heaven somewhere, and everything is going to be a golden glowing event from that moment on. Now, because that's always the case, that at some point someone is going to come along and say something radically different, we're ultimately left with our own experience. We're not going to find some blanket statement that everyone agrees with. And so, as I'm always pointing out, within this non-dual perspective, we ultimately have to come to acknowledge that each and every apparent individual is a unique expression. And some of us can apparently agree on certain general things, but none of us can agree exactly on what existence is, because each of us has a slightly different sense of existence. So within this world of non-duality, there's a general agreement, but each and every specific expression of that so-called awakening and that so-called awakened state, I mean, ultimately all of this is fantasy too, but in this world of apparent form, the description of this so-called awakened state can be an agreement up to a certain point, and beyond that, it can't be an agreement because each and every apparent form is unique. And so ultimately, you're left with your own particular expression, and you don't have to be deciding what your own particular sense of existence will be. You're presented as a particular sense of existence, and you will either be in agreement with someone else's general sense of it or not, but you will never be in exact agreement with anyone else's particular expression. There will always be some difference. So that's all that's arising in response to this person's writing, so we'll move on to the next. Another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, I found your website a month ago or so, and have found the question and answers to be very beneficial. I appreciate your perspective on non-duality and feel that it brings a certain direct simplicity, devoid of a lot of terms such as awareness, oneness, etc. I have a question for you about deep sleep. Many teachers impute that when one truly recognizes this non-dual perspective in direct experience, it is possible to remain aware in deep sleep. A number of teachers make the claim that they are aware in deep sleep. Ramana is said to have said that anything that is not present in deep sleep is not real. For me, there is no memory, no show, no nothing in deep sleep. Except on waking, it seems to provide this apparent body-mind with a deep sense of rest. I find this whole topic of being aware in deep sleep to be quite confusing. I would appreciate if you could share your take on this. Thanks and much gratitude." All right, once again, each and every expression of this non-dual perspective is unique. And the apparent focus of each and every awakened individual, apparent awakened individual, is going to be somewhat different. So certain teachers will say that existence has it's a sense of presence. And then another teacher will come along and say, well, it's not actually a sense of presence legitimately, because in deep sleep there isn't a sense of presence. There isn't even a sense of existing in any way whatsoever. The thoughts fall away. Everything's just, there is no sense of existing. And so what we call life presents itself with a sense of presence and a sense of absence, a sense of existence, a sense of non-existence, that the actuality of the moment encompasses notions like existence and non-existence, presence and absence. And so in that apparent non-existence, in that apparent absence, that's also an expression of what's actually here. And it may be an even deeper expression of what's actually here. Because the actuality is here even in the sense of non-existence. And so some teachers will say outright that everything that seems to present itself in that moment of existence has got to be ultimately unreal, because, or obviously unreal, because whatever this is also presents itself as the absence of all of that. And so the true essence of what this is here, even when there's no sense of anything existing at all. Now, someone else will say, oh, you know, with this awakening, I am totally aware, even in deep sleep. Another person, like U.G. Krishnamurti, will say that with awakening, it's the case that all of the glands in your body will swell to an extraordinary size with the phases of the moon. Within the traditional scriptures, it says that there is no awareness in the first place. So this whole debate about awareness and the absence of awareness, or there is no presence, there is no real presence as opposed to absence, that these are fantasies. These are descriptions of form that don't actually exist, that what's here has no particular form. And so they state that even in awareness, there is no awareness. In deep sleep, there is no deep sleep. In stupidity, there is no stupidity. In ignorance, there is no ignorance. In awakening, there is no awakening. They're simply stating that why bother to even get caught up in these kinds of debates? Like, these descriptions are fantasies. They're attempting to focus on some stable form that could possibly be described when there isn't any stable form that could possibly be described. That the descriptions themselves are just meaningless sound pointing to forms that don't actually exist, or states that don't actually exist, states of mind, waking and sleeping, clarity and confusion, joy and sorrow. All of this attempt to focus on these passing appearances is just frustrating, because you attempt to describe life in one way. By the time you describe it, it's already moved on to something else. So here's my take on this, that to focus on the world of description, to attempt to nail down some particular description of existence, is endlessly frustrating. It's a world of sorrow, a world of endless frustration. And even if we do acknowledge that all of this is a totally unexplainable event, there's still going to be apparent forms and apparent descriptions that are a legitimate expression of this unformed event. And so what we call thoughts will still come and go, but they themselves are a totally mysterious event, simply moving and shifting and dancing on their own. And in the world of apparent form, each and every apparent form is unique. No two snowflakes are the same. No two leaves are the same. No two trees are the same. No two moments are the same. And so it is that no two expressions of non-duality are exactly the same. Because even though there can be a general agreement of what a non-dual sensibility is, each and every specific so-called awakening and each and every specific description of that so-called awakening has got to be unique. And this is the situation that we're left with. Whether we like it or not, this is the situation we're left with. You may agree, in general, with a non-dual sensibility, a non-dual sense of existence, but your specific experience within the apparent world of form, your specific experience of existence is unique, and how that apparent non-dual awakening will play out, what will arise with that so-called non-dual sensibility, is unique in each and every apparent case. Whether we like it or not, this is the situation we're left with. And that's all that's arising in response to this specific question. Okay, another person has written in saying, "Hi Daryl, when this non-dual thing starts to express itself, have you heard of people becoming extremely tired? Thanks." And yes, that is one of the common apparent things that arises with this non-dual realization. In some cases, it can feel like it's a release of certain energies, and in other certain situations, in other apparent individuals, it can feel extremely fatiguing, because, you know, it feels as though the entire conceptual world is rearranging itself, and in that there's a fatigue. Now, it can also be the case that if we're still focusing on descriptions like "I have no control" or "there is no free will," you know, that's not truly a non-dual perspective, because a non-dual perspective is not left making some definitive statement of existence. It's simply pointing out that all the definitive statements are suspect, that they don't actually hold true. They aren't a true description of existence. However, in the initial so-called realization of that, there can still be a focus on certain, on the attempt to define existence to some degree. And it can sometimes come out in statements like, there is no free will, I'm not in control. And that can actually give rise to certain depressing feelings, which give rise to a feeling of tiredness. So, you know, it's... But within this acknowledgement that nothing true can be said about this happening, there's just this happening, in the initial rearranging of all the concepts, it's almost as though this point has to sift through every existing concept within the apparent mind. And that moves and shifts in whatever way it moves and shifts, and it may happen quickly, it may apparently happen over a long period of time. There can be a feeling of fatigue in that rearrangement. In some cases, it can even feel like the thinking realm is somewhat stunned, and there's a fatigue with that. So that's one of the common things that is described within this process. All right, and last but not least, we have someone writing in saying, hello again from Paris. If it's not too late, I thought I'd send you a comment and not a question. It's been a fascinating observation for me to notice that after having been exposed to your perspective over a year ago, my experience of that is itself ever shifting and ever changing. Of course, my experience of everything has revealed itself as equally ungraspable. But to realize that the experience of your perspective and the insights it engendered is absolutely unprecedented has been a wonder in itself. My previous storylines about teachings and insights were to view them as things to be deepened, explored, clarified, etc. And now, amidst the countless things I think I've read, heard, thought, or remembered, here's a perspective that destroys its own solidity. Looking closer, it becomes apparent that the message, the messenger, and the recipient dissolve. There isn't any such thing as this perspective. The mirage seems to be talking, but to whom? What else is there? Who else? Else is just a concept, itself mirage-like. Just ask a two-day-old baby, or the wind, or one so-called self in deep sleep, or in the grave. The implications of such a perspective are themselves shimmering, contingent, and thus not more relevant or less relevant than anything experienced anyhow, anywhen. Nothing to defend. What a relief. The most fascinating thing is that even this message isn't a message. Thanks again. And so I would just like to say yes to what's expressed here. This person relates very deeply to this sense of this apparent person relates very deeply to this sense of existence being a totally unexplainable happening, a totally unformed, unexplainable happening, and is noting that, you know, what I'm saying here is that this perspective that I seem to be presenting in this moment it's not a perspective that's being presented in this moment. It's a totally undefinable happening. There's no way of saying what this is, what it is that's happening in this moment. It's just that something seems to be happening. Ultimately, there's no way of defining it in any way whatsoever. And in that acknowledgement, in this so-called non-dual perspective, there's the acknowledgement that even this so-called awakening is not something called an awakening. It's just one of the mysterious expressions of this undefinable happening. And in the world of apparent form, each and every apparent form is unique. So that even in expressing this so-called non-dual perspective, it's not saying that everybody should have this perspective. It's not saying that this is the way everyone should see life. It's not saying that this is the one true way of seeing life. It's just saying, here's a perspective. You either relate to it or you don't relate to it. It's not necessary that anyone relate to it. And ultimately, it's saying, this isn't even a perspective. This is a totally unexplainable happening, simply happening. And so even the notion of being somebody with a true point of view falls away. There isn't any true point of view within this so-called non-dual perspective. There isn't even a non-dual perspective. And so the fantasy dismantles itself. But again, this person's perspective, this person's expression is a unique expression. Within a non-dual sensibility, a general agreement with a non-dual sensibility doesn't have to focus on what this person is expressing. An agreement with a non-dual sensibility can have many different focuses. Many different apparent things will make themselves obvious or make themselves exciting. And what this person is expressing in this moment is just one of the mysterious expressions that we would call a non-dual sensibility. All right, man, this has run on quite long. So that's it, folks. I've got to get ready for work. Thanks for all the questions. Thanks for tuning in. I wish you well in the coming month. I wish you only good things, but as always, I know it's going to be a mixed bag of things. Even if you're awakened, it's going to be a mixed bag of things, an apparent mixed bag of things. Highs and lows, clarities and confusions, joys and sorrows, pains and pleasures. Even though, who knows what it is. So, till next time, take care. Bye.